I thought today might be appropriate to go back, I think, 42 years and consider the events when Santi was here, 1977. Been rediscovering all this stuff in the process of writing my second volume of my experiences with the Masters, the years with the Jig. And I've gone over all this material. It will all be included in the book. But I'm reading it from the original Sant Bani Volume 2, September 1977 issue. So it begins with Seattle. We left Boston on the morning of Friday, June 10th, 1977. On a United Airlines jet for Seattle, where we were scheduled to spend one night before entering Canada on the following day. Plane made one stop in Denver, and to our surprise, we were met at the airport by three dear ones, Faye Mather and Don and Linda Turnage, who had driven many hours from Glenwood Springs on the other side of the mountains just to see Santi for a few minutes. The stay here was very short, and we had decided against notifying the satsangis generally. Faye is a stewardess for United and so was able to arrange a private room where Santi and those of us who were accompanying him could sit quietly together. His body was still weak from the malaria it had suffered only a few weeks before, and he utilized much of the time for resting. We were very grateful to Faye, Dawn, and Linda for their thoughtful and helpful selfless service. On the flight to Seattle, I explained to Santi that Norma Fraser, the dedicated group leader in Nanaimo, our first stop in Canada, had arranged a charter flight for us direct from Seattle to Nanaimo, which would, among other things, simplify and make easier the immigration procedure at the border. Santi listened very carefully. And then he said gravely, "Whatever Hazur sends, I accept." It was only later that I understood the significance of his response. At the Seattle airport, we were met by many devoted satsangis, some of them familiar. One carload of dear ones had driven nonstop from Vermont and were there at the airport to greet us when we arrived. And some not so familiar, although they became very familiar and very sweet to us all in the weeks ahead. The Seattle group leader, Helen Perkins, my sister, had very kindly turned her house over to Santi and his party, and the accommodations were very comfortable. Satsang was held that evening at the home of Jeanne and Luis Rodriguez, and before the satsang, Santi saw all the Seattle satsangis as a group, as well as giving some private interviews. He was very pleased with the love and devotion of the Seattle satsang, and he told me specifically that another day should be allotted for them on the way back, which, with his grace, was done. Following morning, on the way to the airport to get the charter flight to Nanaimo, we stopped at the sanctuary that the Seattle satsangis are building on the property of two dear ones, Al and Ann Sutherland, for satsang and meditation purposes. Santi held satsang there briefly and blessed the building as the satsangis had requested. We arrived at the airport in plenty of time, but our flight was 2 hours late. Since the little trailer where we were waiting in the small plane section of the airport was crammed to overflowing with satsangis, Santi, in effect, held an unscheduled satsang for most of the 2 hours. He spoke in Punjabi for more than half an hour with Mr. Yagya Sharma, a longtime initiate of Master Kripal Singh, and at the conclusion told Papu to translate it all for everyone else. And one of the more impressive, although there were many incidents like it on the tour, demonstrations of his translator's ability, Papu talked without faltering for more than half an hour, translating word for word what Santi had said, even though he had not even known ahead of time he was supposed to translate it. It consisted mostly of stories about Mastanaji, who are the Baluchistani Mastana, the strange god-intoxicated contemporary of Master Kripal, who had enormous influence in the northwestern part of India, and for whom Sanchi has great love and respect. Finally, the plane arrived, carrying Norma Fraser, the group leader and our hostess for the next week, and Elliot McLaughlin of Vancouver, who did a great deal of selfless service during our stay in Nanaimo. They greeted us very lovingly. It was Norma's first physical meeting with Sanchi, and we got on board for what most of us thought was to be a routine flight to Nanaimo. At the Victoria Airport, the airplane had two propellers and 10 seats, 9 passengers plus pilot, and was a lot of fun. The otherworldly beauty of the country over which it flew was described very well by Michael Rayson in the July-August issue of Sanpani. All of us, including the master, enjoyed looking out the window. We weren't flying very high, and it was a spectacular view. Norma, Elliot, and the pilot were all in agreement that the simplest and easiest way to pass through immigration and customs would be to stop at Victoria Airport, which we did. I had no thought of any trouble. Great pains had been taken to ensure that the papers were all in order. And while I knew that Canada had often been difficult for Indians to enter in the last few years, I anticipated at the worst some insulting questions. The polite young man behind the counter was the last person to insult anybody. He checked our papers carefully and agreed that everything appeared to be perfectly fine. But since he was new on the job, he thought he'd better check with his boss, who was at home. In a few minutes, he was back from the telephone. "The boss wants to see you personally. He's coming right down. He'll be here in 15 minutes. Half an hour later, the boss walked in, an elderly, white-haired, very tough man with steely eyes that glinted all around. He was puffing on a cigarette continuously. The polite young man asked him if he would like to see our papers. He said gruffly, "What I want to see is the captain of the plane." And he and the pilot disappeared into his office. When they came out a long time later, it was explained to us that the problem was not with our papers, which were in order, but with the airline, Pacific Coastal Airways. Any carrier bringing foreign nationals into Canada has to have a large bond posted, ostensibly to cover the cost of transporting them back immediately to their place of origin should they be judged unfit. Pacific Coastal did not have such a bond posted, and therefore our party could not enter Canada. The pilot, who had flown this trip hundreds of times for another airline, was on his first flight for Pacific Coastal. Since his previous employers had always taken care of this for him, he was not even aware of the regulation and literally didn't know what to do. After long deliberation, the immigrations man agreed to let us in if $1,000 bond was posted on each of the three Indians. That is, of course, Sanchi, Patiji, and Papu. But where to get $3,000 on a Saturday afternoon? Several phone conversations took place between the pilot and his boss at Nanaimo. At one point, the boss told him to take us all back to Seattle. At one point also, I might mention, I didn't include this in the article, but somebody suggested that Judith and I could go on and Sanchi, Papu, and Patiji could go back. And I thought of what that would look like. Oh, God. Anyway, we quickly turned that down. Time was passing by. It would have been easy for us to become depressed and nervous, and perhaps we did a little. But we did not and could not succumb to such feelings because Sanchi wouldn't let us. Despite all that was happening, despite our being forced to wait all this time in the big hall of the airport on little hard chairs with no food or conveniences, despite the really depressing prospect of being sent back to Seattle, he never for one second allowed us to dwell on any of that. He was bubbling over with good humor throughout. He told us funny stories and made jokes out of everything negative that was happening. but he was also very loving and compassionate and understanding of how we felt. He told Norma on many occasions that she had made excellent arrangements. She was not at fault in any way, that this was all Master's will and it could not be helped. When we told him that we might have to go back to Seattle, he shook his head. No, we will be delayed, that's all. About halfway through the afternoon, a commercial jetliner from Seattle flew in. Among the hundreds of passengers who disembarked and who took precedence over us, since they absorbed all the attention of the immigration's personnel as long as they were there, was David Hughes, a satsangi from Ohio, who was on his way to Nanaimo to see Sanchi. He was the only satsangi on the plane. All the others had gone up by other ways. He walked through the door and saw Sanchi sitting on a hard chair directly in front of him. He immediately sat at his feet, speechless with amazement. He eventually went through immigrations and then came back and joined us. Sanchi made many jokes, and I'm not at all sure that they were fully jokes, that the whole thing had happened for his sake. In the meantime, although we did not learn all this until later, there were between 60 and 70 satsangis gathered at Nanaimo Airport waiting to see Sanchi. I need only mention that in Master's great love and incredible grace, and with the loving generosity of his dear children, the entire sum of $3,000 was raised from those 60-odd people, none of whom was wealthy, in the space of an hour or so, and another plane, this one carrying the airline boss, plus Aaron Stevens, Mr. P.S. Nagra, and other satsangis, flew down to help us cross the border. And Mr. Nagra, I might mention, who was instrumental not only in bringing Sanchi here in 1977, but also in bringing Kripal to Vancouver in 1963, and in getting the work started in this area in the first place. A wonderful, very distinguished man whom I knew not terribly well, but I did know him, has left the body just in the last few days. I just heard that. Aaron had to take personal responsibility for each of the Indians, and each of them had to personally promise the tough immigrations man that he would be good. Looking through the door while Sanchi was in there, watching the man blow smoke in his face, hearing him refer to him as that fellow, watching Sanchi's totally patient humility, I understood perhaps more than ever what exactly is involved when the word becomes flesh, when the emperor of Sachkhan becomes a beggar for our sake. Yet not once, then or later, did Sanchi indicate the slightest unhappiness or displeasure with anything. He reiterated that it was Master's will, and he was obviously happy and content with it. In Nanaimo, he told us there was a secret connected with the incident, and he would tell us later what it was. We never remembered to ask him, and up to now he has not told us. And actually, he never did tell us, partly because as the years went by, other things took precedent in our minds, and we never thought to ask him again. Weary but thankful, we climbed back onto the plane for the final 20 minutes of the flight, almost exactly 5 hours after we had arrived. Nanaimo, and people, you know, this was written from my perspective at the time, and it is possible that I was mistaken in some points, I don't know. And my perspective was, of course, that of who I was back 42 years ago. So bear that in mind. If I'm wrong about anything on this, forgive me. Nanaimo is a small, beautiful, progressive city on the east coast of Vancouver Island, just across the bay from the city of Vancouver. The Nanaimo satsang consists of 8 persons, and those 8, together with some loving assistance from a few devotees in Vancouver, handled all the arrangements and did all the work involved in hosting not only Sanchi and his party, but approximately 200 satsangis, mostly from Western Canada, who came to be with him. And they did it so well that none of us who were there will ever forget the beauty, peace, and calm of that blessed week. We arrived, finally, about 7 p.m. on Saturday, June 11th at Nanaimo Airport. We were driven by Leo Pallone, our faithful Sevadar chauffeur, to Yellow Point Lodge in nearby Ladysmith. Here, Sanchi, his party, and many others were accommodated. The lodge is a beautiful seaside resort. We had it all to ourselves, and group darshans are held every afternoon on the lawn beside the ocean. The group here was smaller than at many other stops, so that by dividing the people into four groups of about 40 each person was able to see him at least once a day relatively closely. But many people either could not afford to stay at the lodge or they had small children. Children under 15 were not allowed due to insurance regulations. They stayed at the Four All Seasons campground a mile or so away, and every night Sanchi went down there, gave darshan to the children for 15 minutes, and then held satsang at the big meeting hall there. The people staying at the campground were bused back and forth to the lodge so that they could attend the group darshans. The only real hardship the no children rule caused was on two 12-year-old boys who were fully initiated and who were following Sanchi on tour. It was hard on them not to be able to see him. And at the children's darshan, he had them sit near him and gave them special attention. One afternoon, toward the end of the stay, their temporary guardian rented a boat and brought them along the shoreline of the lodge. We noticed them during the group darshans, and Sanchi went down to the shore to greet them. As long as they stayed in the boat, they weren't violating the rule. He was very pleased to see them. The group darshans on Monday, June 13th, the first day on which they were held, struck me as being specially beautiful. At Sant Bani Ashram, I had not been able to attend the group darshans regularly because of so many responsibilities. Here, Sanchi made it plain to me that he not only wanted me to attend, but that he expected me to do so. It was part of my job. Sitting through all four darshans that afternoon, out on the open lawn with the ocean not far away and very visible, watching him being so loving and jolly and master-like and wonderful, left me with an incredible high. The following morning I overslept, however, and when I finally got up and sat for meditation, the thought kept coming, go and see him. But I felt guilty over having overslept, and I did not feel I had meditated enough to go see him. I wasn't sure whether it was my still somewhat intoxicated mind manufacturing this just to get some more darshan, or whether it was really him calling me. But the thought got stronger and stronger, and finally it came very clearly that, as Maulana Rumi said, 20 minutes in the company of a saint is better than 100 years of meditation. And I had heard Sanchi say that, and it was suddenly self-evident. I knew in every pore of my body that I was to go to him. So I slipped out and went over to his cabin. Sanchi was sitting up in bed waiting for me, and he greeted me very warmly and invited me in. I told him right off that I had overslept and about my call to come and mental struggle. He didn't condone the oversleeping, but he made it clear that he had indeed called me. He gave me tea with his own hands, and we talked for over an hour. One of the things that came up concerned funeral rites. He questioned me closely about Western customs in this regard, and I answered to the best of my knowledge. Finally, he said that it would be very good if satsangis led the way in simplifying these rites, which were unnecessary and based on a wrong understanding of the role of the body after the soul has left. He said that either simple burial or cremation or donating one's body to medical research would be good, and that if satsangis began practicing this, then not only would it be easier for their surviving relatives, who would not have the crushing burden of the funeral expenses to contend with, but it would also give other people courage to do the same, and a useful social reform would be quietly underway. And this was the beginning of the cemetery at Sant Bani Ashram, by the way, because of this conversation with Sanchi, I kept this in mind. And a few years later, we did establish the cemetery there that we could fill either simple burial or cremation. None of the standard practices are followed in the funeral industry. After lunch that day, I began to feel sleepy. I thought, well, the group darshans are starting soon, but I really feel sleepy. And after all, I had that beautiful hour with him this morning. He won't mind if I just take a nap. I'll go a little later. So I lay down and went to sleep and had horrible dreams. Finally, I woke up and realized that it was of the utmost importance that I get to those darshans immediately. I ran out of the lodge and down to the lawn just as a group was breaking up. Sanchi saw me coming and smiled. When I went to him to explain all about my sleepiness, he abruptly turned his back and walked 10 feet away. I gulped, then tried to maneuver around so that I could see his face, but he kept his back to me until I had finished my piece. He made no comment, but he invited me to sit down. I was shaken a bit. I had been through a very similar experience with Master Kripal Singh, and I understood that I had displeased him. Judith told me that he had asked her many times why I wasn't there. She explained to him that I was sleeping, and finally he said he had that hour with me this morning and he thinks he doesn't need to come now, which of course was exactly what I had been thinking. He forgave me, but the incident made me realize, and should make everyone else realize, that it is no small or easy thing to be a companion of a saint, that a very high standard is demanded, and that which might pass without notice in others is commented on very sharply in us. Later on the tour in California, this was brought home to me even more vividly, as we will see. The satsangs in Nanaimo were especially beautiful. One night he commented on a hymn of Sajubai, a famous woman master of the 19th century in India, and explained very clearly that in the eyes of God, there was no difference between women and men, and that women had been masters and could be masters. That talk will be published in due course. On Friday, June 17th at 4 a.m., 26 persons were initiated into Surat Shabad Yoga, a beautiful, calm, and powerful initiation in the ambrosial hours. The next morning, a farewell darshan was held at the campground so that everyone, including the children, might attend at once. Sanchi asked me to say a few words, and I voiced what was in everyone's heart. This is a very small satsang, and they have done a very big thing. Everyone who benefited from that week, and there were many, owes the Nanaimo satsang a great debt. After the farewell darshan, our dear brother Leo drove us to Norma Fraser's home, which Sanchi blessed with a short visit, and met her husband, whom he loved. Then into Leo's car one final time and off to the airport. Different airline this time, Air West, but the same type of plane. And again, a really enjoyable flight to Vancouver, this time nonstop. And I want to read at least some of the talk that I mentioned on hymn of Sajubai, because this is a very remarkable talk, one of many very remarkable talks that Sanchi gave on this tour. It's called Masters Come for Sinners, and it is included in Streams in the Desert, but I'm reading it from the March 1978 Sant Bani. Sanchi begins with a hymn, "Now, O God, pull me toward you." This is the Bani of Sajubai. The reason for taking the writings of different Mahatmas and saints is to show that all saints and masters who came in the past gave out one message. Mahatmas make us understand that the God for whom we are searching and who has given life to all of us is one. The God for the American people and the God for the Indian and all other people is the same. Mahatmas say there is only one practice by which we can achieve that God, and that way, that path, is within all human bodies. Up to this time, he has never been achieved from outside the human body, nor will he ever be achieved except in the human body. Guru Nanak says that those who are trying to realize him outside of their human body are making useless efforts and are wasting their time. There is no question of man or woman. It is not true that only men can realize God and women cannot. Both man and woman can do the devotion of God. There is no question of caste either. People of all castes can do the devotion of God. Many women have become Mahatmas. Sajubai, Dayabai, Mirabai, Mahatma Gargi, Rabia Basri, all these people were perfect Mahatmas. That's why Sajubai's Bani is presented to you. Sajubai's master was Charan Das. She was born in a Rajputana family, and she was a perfect meditator. She initiated many people and made them cross the ocean of life. Mahatmas come in this world carrying much humility with them, and they have only humility. Master used to say, God has everything except humility. He is the all-owner. To whom should he show his humility? So now with very much humility, she is begging God, O God, pull me toward you and shower grace on me. Only because of your pull can I create the yearning to meet you, and only with your grace, love, and help will I be able to do the devotion. Do not count my bad deeds. Forgive me so that you will maintain your reputation of forgiving. If the Guru only looked at our bad deeds and bad qualities, he could not forgive us. And for the rest of our lives, we would be able neither to come to the satsang nor to get nam from him. Kabir Sahib says, the saints come into this world as washermen. The washerman accepts everyone's clothes. He doesn't care if the clothes are from the oil merchant or the baker or the gentleman. But the thing is that the clothes of the baker or the oil merchant will need more attention, more work, while the gentleman's clothes will be easily washed. But because he is proud of his honest skill and he knows that he can clean everyone's clothes, he accepts everyone's clothes. Similarly, saints know about nam and rely on nam. They know within whom they will keep that nam and who will one day go back to Sachkhand. Kabir Sahib says, when nam dwells in the heart, all sins go away, just as a little bit of fire finishes the heap of hay. Guru Nanak says, we, the worldly people, committed many sins, but when we got the nam, it worked like fire and burned our sins just as wood is burned by fire. Kabir Sahib says, even a leper who is meditating on nam is better than a person whose body is made of gold. Sajubai says, ask God, O God, shower grace on me and don't look at my bad qualities, because now you are concerned about me and you are taking my care. Age after age, your glory is such as is sung in the Vedas and Puranas. Now Sajubai says, I am not requesting of you any new thing. The Vedas and Puranas all bear this witness, that God is always liberating the sinners. That's why I am requesting you to liberate me also. Master used to say, the masters always come for the sinners. There was one Udham Singh, who was a very famous robber of Maza, and he used to torment the disciples of Master Sawan Singh, who were coming to see him, and sometimes he drowned them in the river. But when he learned the importance of the saints, he came to Master Sawan Singh and got initiated by him. After that, he used to put a piece of cloth at his mouth and praise Master Sawan Singh constantly in front of the Sangha, when Master Sawan Singh used to say to him, "Stop doing that," he would say, "Let me remove all my sins, because with this mouth I have criticized you a lot. Now let me remove those sins by praising you." Similarly, there was a famous dacoit in Rajasthan who had committed many murders. When he came to Master, Master asked him, "What is your profession?" He replied, "All my life I have been a hunter of men." Master asked him, "Now what is your idea?" He replied, "That's all over. Now I have come to repent and take refuge at your feet." Master gave him initiation and he became a very good man. And I knew him, not well, but I did know him slightly. His name was Rajinder Singh, and he was a very familiar figure at Sawan Ashram. And it was known that he had been a dacoit, and many of the younger Western disciples would approach him and ask him about it, which irritated him no end. He would say, "Now look, that was 18 years ago," or whatever it was. He did not want to talk about that. And I would point out, you know, these people were not minor sinners, okay? Udham Singh had drowned people who were coming to see Sawan Singh in the River Bayas. You think of what kind of karma that involves. And yet the master not only forgave him, he initiated him. There are many stories like that, and they should make any of us who feel like, you know, we're not worthy, we're not good enough, we are such terrible sinners that no one could possibly love us. If we feel like that, just think of these guys and how the master treated them. And he will treat us, I assure you, in the same way. In the same way, there is the story of Ajamal. Ajamal was the son of a pundit, but he was caught up in adultery and was defamed in his community or caste. As you know, in India, if anyone in a caste is doing bad deeds, he is thrown out of the caste, and the other people in the caste don't have any relation with him and hate him. So that Ajamal was thrown out of his caste, and he was thrown out of his village also. Outside of the village, he made a small hut and lived there. Once a perfect Mahatma came there, and he was surprised to find a hut outside of the village. So he came to the hut and asked Ajamal, "Why is this?" He told him, "I am a sinner. This is the hut of Ajamal the sinner. I made this mistake in my youth and the people of the community have thrown me out. I am a very great sinner." As you know, saints have full power and have many sticks to rebuke the souls. They have their own ways of liberating souls. It is not necessary that they liberate souls only by giving nam initiation. If they want, they can liberate souls only by looking at them once. They have many ways. Because that perfect Mahatma knew that Ajamal's attention was scattered all over the world, he knew he could not be liberated by giving initiation. He had to use other means. So he told him, "All right, whatever you have done in the past is done. Now forget about that. But you will have one son, and you should name him Narayan. Narayan means God. And your son Narayan will liberate you." Now when that Mahatma told him, "You will have a son and name him Narayan," all the bad thoughts that Ajamal had, which were scattered in the world, were concentrated on the name Narayan. And he was always thinking of that soul, that son, who was going to come to his home, and he was very grateful to the Mahatma. He always remembered that Narayan. When his end time came, he was still remembering that Narayan. When the angels of death came to take him and were giving him a very hard time, he cried, "Narayan, oh Narayan, come and save me." So Guru Nanak wrote in his Bani of that occasion, "He did the devotion of God, understanding him as his son. Repeating the name Narayan, Narayan came to save him." So he did the devotion of God, understanding him as his son, and still God came to liberate him. That's why Master Sawan Singh Ji used to say, "If you cannot meditate and your mind is not steady, at least you should love the master." And you can love the Master. The more you think of him, the more you can love him, and the more you will be inclined in his direction. The more you will remember, the more you will become his form. Your Nam is the liberator of sinners. Hearing this, my soul is determined. Sajobai says, when I knew that only your Nam can liberate sinners, then I had determination and faith in you and believed in you. After having faith in you, I got Nam from you, and now I am begging you to liberate me, because I know that your Nam can remove all my sins. Just as if we put soap or detergent to dirty clothes, all the dirt will be removed. In the same way, Nam removes all our sins. Tulsi Sahib says, rust cannot eat gold, ants cannot eat iron. The devotee of the Master, whether he be good or bad, Kal cannot accept him, and he cannot go to hell. I am ignorant, you know everything about me. You are all-pervading, all-conscious. Very often I have said this in the satsang, that those who are meditating according to the instructions of the Master, they have never said that their Master or this path is untrue, because this path is true, and those who are meditating according to the instructions of the Master go back to God. This path leads the soul toward God, because this path has come from God, and God himself has made this path. We praise the Masters, but we understand them only as men. As long as we are not doing meditation, we do not understand them as more than human beings. Those who have gone within never ask any question of their Master, because they know that he is all conscious. What question should I ask of him who knows everything? But a disciple says to Guru Arjan Dev, we are illiterate and foolish and have no good qualities. Because we have left your nectar, the Nam, we ate poison. What are the poisons? The poisons are the worldly pleasures. He said, we learned about your good path. When we came to your good path, we understood about you, and the fear of the angels of death was removed. Sajobai says here, I am asking you, even though you know everything about my heart. I have taken refuge at your lotus feet. O Kripal, and of course Kripal means merciful and is used here in that sense, compassionate Swami, Master. Now Sajobai says, I have only support of your lotus feet. And now you have to be gracious. You have to shower grace on me. Now only you can help me. Guru Nanak Sahib says, if that gracious Saint Kripal, the merciful, showers grace on your soul, even critics can be liberated along with the dear ones. You know, the things in this discourse are extremely profound and worth doing a lot of meditation on. It strikes me as incredible sometimes that the Masters, they're not interested in punishment. They're not interested in reward either. Those things are what Kal does. Punishment and reward are of the negative power. What they are interested in is loving us because we exist and taking us up because we are his children. And we are his children. Everyone in the world is his children if they knew it. And sooner or later they will know it. As Master Kripal said, we have to rise above to universalism. And universalism means, among other things, that eventually everyone will come back to God and sit in his lap. It's the nature of the universe that that has to happen. It may take many, many lifetimes. It may take many trips around the cycle of 84, but it's still going to happen. And that it will happen, the fact that the Master shows grace and mercy even to sinners like Udham Singh and Rajinder Singh, this is a foretaste of what will happen to everyone, no matter how bad they are. And the way that he dealt with Ajamal, the master knows what he's doing. And I would say that anyone who ever received a glance of grace from him knows that, should know, that they have gotten what they need. As Master Kripal used to say, the time spent in searching is counted. And that day is the greatest in a man's life in which the idea of searching for God is aroused in his heart. So the Master knows what we need, and he is both loving and lovable. And because he is lovable, that is our way of salvation. All right.